One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Everybody, we got a great one today, you know, for a change. And this time I am not lying. I got Mark Elias and Ari Berman. Mark Elias, you might know from television. He's the Democrats' lead election lawyer. You've probably seen him on your color TV. Ari Berman writes for Mother Jones magazine about election law. We've had them on together before. They're always great, but this one, I don't know what happened, but they're on fire. They worry that there's some complacency among Democrats because this past midterm just wasn't the nightmare we anticipated in terms of voter suppression. But they are alarmed and warning us about what's coming. What states are doing to make it harder for certain people to vote? Who would that be? People of color, immigrants, students, all of the above. Here's a clip from the interview that sort of sums up the whole podcast. It's Ari laying out a very scary future that Republicans have systematically created, a political system where there's just no recourse to protect democracy. And then he sees where he's going. He kind of bails out with a lame, but I don't think that's going to happen. And I sort of call him on it and hilarity ensues. Check it out.
If they want to do something, they will figure out a way to do it. It doesn't matter. We will have a political system in which there is no recourse to try to change the undemocratic things that they're doing, because all of the options to try to check the undemocratic things that they're doing will be eventually systematically taken away one by one by one. And I think that's the scary future, where our ability to protect democracy becomes so difficult to potentially non-existent. Now, I don't think we're heading there. I don't think that's what's happening. But I think that's what they would like to happen. I think their ultimate end game.
Well, then let's end with your optimism here by explaining why you're so optimistic.
Well, I don't think I would be described.
That's funny, isn't it? That's a funny moment, isn't it? Look, I've had Mark Elias on many times, and he's always great. We started pairing them up, and now they're like a two-man beach volley team. It's amazing. Watch these guys, except, I mean, listen. But you're going to learn a lot and have fun at the same time, you know, like camp. But there are some serious and sober moments, so get ready for a bit of a ride. It's a great one today, you know, for a change.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
So today I want to talk about a few things. One, if there are any vestiges from this past election that we should be talking about from the 20 election and maybe from 22 in terms of stuff that may be prosecuted. For example, the all I need is 11,780 votes. I don't know why it's taken so fucking long, but that's a violation of election law, right? We think.
I think it violates Georgia state law. And all I can say is that the Georgia criminal process seems to involve a lot more steps.
Yeah, well, she gets a special grand jury.
But it's a special grand jury that actually can't then indict anyone. It's a special grand jury that issues a report.
And then I thought what they did would do all the work that a grand jury would work and then just seamlessly hand it over. And the new grand jury would go like, well, give us the weekend to read this, or maybe even a week, a long weekend, maybe. Because remember, she said it was going to be, what did she say? The first trial, she said it was going to be imminent or something like that.
I don't remember what the DA said. I just, and I'm not an expert in Georgia law. It's just, it seems like there just seem to be a lot of steps.
Now, I've asked this before, but it seems to me that violating Georgia law in a federal election is also a federal crime. Is that wrong or right?
No, look, I mean, you're right in that, and we know that Jack Smith, one of their charges is to look at all of this, and we'll see what that yields.
Okay, and then they got the fake electors aspect of that, and it could be RICO. It could be a RICO, which is made for gangsters, right, for mob, but it's like a conspiracy, right? So they may get up on RICO charges, both either in Georgia or perhaps in the federal government. Let me introduce these guys. We've had both on a number of times before. Ari Berman writes for Mother Jones on election stuff, right? On election law, and has joined us a number of times before. Mark Elias now heads up what's the Elias Law Group, and it used to be at Perkins Coie when you represented me there. Now you represent me at the Elias Law Group, and you ran my recount.
I did.
That was fun, wasn't it?
In retrospect, every day that right now, for those people who don't know, Kerry Lake, who lost the governorship in Arizona, is continuing to contest that election result in court, and my firm is representing Governor Hobbs. And I am amused because there is constantly press coverage about this in Arizona and elsewhere about how long could Kerry Lake possibly pursue this? Like how many things will she go through before she finally accepts that she's lost? And I always look at my watch and I'm like, well, Norm Coleman was still going at this point. we've still got a few months.
Well, they knew they lost. They just wanted to delay me getting there because I was one more vote.
Correct.
And that was it. And by the time I got there, because Specter had gone over to the Democratic Party, I was the 60th. And because of that, we were able to get the Affordable Care Act. So
yes, I recall when the state Supreme Court ruled against Norm Coleman. and he conceded. I remember the number of people in the media were like, look how gracious Norm Coleman is. And I was like, what would a non-gracious Norm Coleman look like? I mean, like literally, like what credit are you giving him? He lost in the state Supreme Court. Like what, that he didn't then somehow manufacture something in the Supreme Court? I mean, I am not on the Norm Coleman was gracious side of the fence.
Al, it's still amazing to think that you are the 60th Democratic senator.
Yeah.
I mean, that is almost inconceivable.
Well, you mean today, now, because today,
to imagine that the structure of the Senate would allow you to have 60 Democrats, is it's hard to imagine that happening now.
Or the structure of our pop. Well, you know, Barack Obama had a great election and brought some people in. I mean, if I won by 312 votes, I think Barack helped. Although Barack didn't show up in my state at the end there. He could have done that. I could have gotten probably, if he had and campaigned with me, I would have been there right away.
But Ari, to your point, I mean,
but I'm not bitter.
Think about it, though, Ari. Either at the time that Al was elected or shortly before, you had two Democratic senators from South Dakota, two Democratic senators from North Dakota, two Democratic senators from Montana, Democratic senators in, you know, Louisiana, in Missouri, in Florida. It was a very different map.
Oh, that's a good way to remember.
Yeah, and I mean, it's possible to imagine maybe getting one or two in those places, but it's impossible to imagine the Dakotas being represented by all Democrats, or, you know, Missouri having two Democrats, or whatever it is.
Well, things can change again. These things kind of tend to go slowly. So, Mark, I did a speech in Palm Springs the other day. I think I told you this, but I ran into one of the three judges on the three-judge panel that heard the first case. And then it was appealed to the Supreme Court, and they ruled for me because I won. But she told me that Ben Ginsburg was lying at lunch and after the day was over. For our listeners and for Ari, basically, there was this long trial, and this is long, right, Mark, in terms of this wouldn't have happened in Virginia or some other place.
As I pointed out several times, at one point, one of the judges said, well, in Minnesota, we'd rather get it done right than get it done fast. And I said, well, you've given up on fast. At this point, you might as well go for right.
Well, it was slow. And anyway, so there would be the morning in court, and then you and Ben Ginsburg, the Republican lawyer, who's considered something of a hero now because he's not a Trump guy.
Ari would know that, right?
I mean, that's another thing that's sort of inconceivable, is that Ben Ginsburg, who was the go-to lawyer for the Republican Party, pretty much the architect of Bush v. Gore, is now a defender of democracy. Yeah. I mean, that's almost as hard to imagine as Democrats having 60 seats in the Senate at this point.
Well, at this point, he wasn't a defender of democracy. In fact, he would go out at lunch and mischaracterize what happened in the courtroom. Then after the afternoon session, he'd come in and mischaracterize what happened in the courtroom. And at a certain point, it was not going well. It was all going pretty much in my direction, because
it was going well for us. Just to be clear,
yeah, it was going very well for us because we won the election, and that was pretty clear. And so finally, Ginsburg asked for pro hoc vice. Describe pro hoc vice.
Yeah, so lawyers are members of individual state bars, so you can be licensed in one state or another, but from time to time you are asked to represent a client.
For example, is Rudy Giuliani now in the New York State Bar?
Rudy Giuliani, I think, is in the process or has been disbarred in New York.
I think he has, but that would have been an example of the state bar he would have been in.
Right. But okay, when you visit another state or another court, you get admitted what's called pro hoc vici, which is essentially a pro forma exercise where the court, where you ask, can I appear in this one case here, even though I'm out of state? And there's a sponsoring lawyer who is a member of that state's bar, who introduces you to the court either in writing or in person. And then that's kind of your gateway to be able to appear before that court.
Okay, so I want to tell this right. After an afternoon session, and I suppose after one of those press conferences where he mischaracterized what happened, the Coleman lawyers went in to ask Pro Hoc Vitae for Mr. Ginsburg, and you were there. And they said, well, we'll consider this overnight. Now, what they did not know is that the judges during lunch ate their lunch in quarters and watched the press conference.
Is that right?
Yes.
They and had like closed circuit TV. Oh, right. That, because it was streamed. There was a service in Minnesota that was like a C-SPAN kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they were watching it, and they watched it also after the – they wanted to see how it was being represented. And, of course, Ginsburg was lying. So they said, well, we'll take this under advisement and tell you our answer in the morning. You were there. I wasn't there, but you, tell me if I'm right. They said, okay. He said, this is the Coleman lawyers. We will grant him pro hoc vice, but you have to understand that if he lies, you guys will be sanctioned. And they said, the Coleman lawyers said, oh, no. No, that's okay.
I think that's a little more of a dramatic telling. But
I think it's just that, well, except that I ran into one of the three judges in Palm Springs, where I gave this speech.
Retired, I assume, at this point?
I think so. And I asked her to give me the rundown on this, because you and I have discussed this before. I think you're a little foggy on it, just a little teeny bit. She confirmed everything I just said. So Ben Ginsburg, he may be a hero now, but oh boy, you know, I didn't like that. But that one's done, of course, a long time ago. But what's remaining from the 20 election? Obviously, the Georgia stuff. I saw that Smith is looking at the companies that did the research for the Trump campaign to find out if there was fraud, to identify the fraud, right? There were two companies, Ari?
Yeah, there were two companies that were tasked with finding the fraud. And of course, they didn't actually find the fraud.
No, what companies were they? Do you remember? They were like,
I don't remember. They're very like generically named companies.
And Ari, this was before the, this is before, when is this?
I don't know. It's all kind of blends together at this point.
I thought it was after the election.
It was after the election. I don't know when exactly. Because there were so many efforts going on in tandem, as you remember, Mark. It was hard to know like who was doing what.
One of them was named Kellogg, I think. Is that one of the...
I can look it up while we talk.
Okay, well, these were like firms that do shit like this, right? And they are hired to find that fraud, right? And they came back, both of them came back with, there's been no fraud.
One is called the Berkeley Research Group.
Okay.
And one is called Simpatico Software Systems.
I think I
really
Simpatico. That Simpatico sounds like they'll do it in your favor for you.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't get Simpatico to be Simpatico.
If you can't get Simpatico to tell you, you're right, client, thanks for the money, then you know you probably don't have a very good case. But both of them said, no, there's nothing here. We looked as hard as we could. Thanks for hiring us. But we've come up with a very, very, very lock solid conclusion, which is there was no fraud, no meaningful fraud that could lead to a change in the election. So that kind of ends that then, doesn't it?
Yeah, and Mark knows this very well, that there was all sorts of documents signed under oath in these various cases, including in Georgia, where they admitted there was no fraud. When they actually had to sign documents under oath.
Who's they?
The Trump campaign. The Trump campaign signed documents admitting that there was no evidence of fraud under oath in various cases.
So they could be charged
with
that.
But then they can, exactly. So they could theoretically not be prosecuted for lying, but then they kept saying publicly there was fraud. And basically what they're trying to prove, correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, because you know more about the legal aspect than I do, is that Trump was intentionally misleading people, that he knew there was no fraud, but he said it anyway. And that's the kind of intentionality you need to have to prove something like racketeering, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, one of the things that was always frustrating at the time, and for those in your audience who don't know, I represented President Biden in the Democratic Party in 65 post-election lawsuits.
How did you do on those? Yeah,
we won pretty mixed. We won 64 of them. Wow. We also won, represented the campaign in the two Georgia recounts and the Wisconsin recount. And those,
but that 65th, the one you lost, that must have been something, because that must, that could have blown the thing wide open, right? Because wasn't it on curing ballots? this is the one you lost. This is, I want you to tell us the one you lost and how it meant nothing.
Yeah. So the one case that Donald Trump prevailed on was what the cutoff date was for people who had cast a mail-in ballot and had, I believe it was that they had failed to sign their mail-in ballot return envelope, whether they had a 5-day period to come in and provide a signature or a 7-day period to come in. The county, it was in one county. One county said 7 days, and the Trump campaign sued saying it should be 5 days. To say we lost it is a little bit of an overstatement. We wound up joining into the lawsuit because we, you know, wanted to be in the lawsuit. But Donald Trump, fair and square, prevailed on cutting off those 2 days. As far as I can tell, and I've looked at this, you know, not exhaustively, I don't think it actually involved any votes. I don't think there actually were any voters who showed up on days 6 or 7 who had failed to sign their absentee ballots. But that was the one case.
Nevertheless, they get to mark it in the winners.
They get to put that legitimately in the winners. But what I was saying, though, and Ari, this goes to your point, Rudy Giuliani said a lot of crazy things in the parking lot of the Four Seasons. But when it came to being in front of a federal judge, even he backed away from all of it. You know, he told the federal judge in Pennsylvania after that press conference that the Trump campaign was not claiming fraud. They had not pled fraud. He wasn't claiming fraud. It was, in his words, quote, not a fraud case. So there was a lot of ass covering in courtrooms and around court proceedings that were inconsistent with what people were saying in public.
Yeah. Okay, so we're still waiting for the indictments in Georgia. There still can be indictments from Jack Smith on some of these kinds of irregularities. Is that true? I mean, specifically on stuff they did in terms of lying about whether there was fraud and that kind of thing. Can their case come up with that?
I've always thought this is relatively straightforward. There is a form that is submitted to the federal government, to the archivist, that says this is the electoral slate that is duly certified by the state. You know, before you get into all the fancy legal statutes around elections specifically and the like, there is a general statute that prohibits submitting false statements to the government. It has struck me that not just in Georgia, but in all these states where you have people signing and submitting false elector slates to the archivist and to Congress, you have pretty straightforward liability under the criminal law. And to the extent that Donald Trump or his allies were coordinating that, they would under conspiracy law. You know, there may be something to it that is more complicated than that, that is the reason why this has not proceeded yet. But that has always struck me as a pretty straightforward legal theory.
Yeah, I agree with Mark. I think one of the difficulties here is that they did so much stuff that had just never been tried before that people, I think, are unsure about how aggressive to be in terms of pushing these claims against them. I mean, I think that seems to be one of the issues here is that no one had really come up with a slate of electors with no basis before, and no one had incited an insurrection before, and no one had filed 65 lawsuits to try to overturn the election before. So all of that was unprecedented. And then the effort to try to figure out how much of it is illegal, and then not just illegal, but the kind of thing that you would actually charge someone, is the thing that's been taking a long time. But I do think it's pretty crazy that Trump, the first indictment was for Stormy Daniels, of all things, which that is a significant case, but I think most people would agree it pales in comparison to trying to overturn an election and incite an insurrection, all things that he has not yet been charged for. So it's just kind of nuts. And Mark, you might have thoughts on why that is. Maybe that was just a more straightforward case, but it does seem like, okay, everyone can understand paying off a porn star to be quiet and why that would be a scandal.
It is tawdry, but it could have decided the election. I mean, if she had talked, you know, remember what happened after the Access Hollywood tape, and then this party almost abandoned him, or many in it. And if another thing, shoe like that had dropped.
Yeah, I guess you could make that argument. I still think that it's probably less significant than trying to overturn an election and inciting an insurrection.
Oh, yeah. And I guess my question is, I'm worried about this stuff taking so long, just because it's bleeding into the next election. And I think if you had asked me a year and a half ago or something, like, how long is this going to take? I would not have imagined that that would be the only indictment now. And it worries me.
Yeah, I'm not sure it worries me. And Ari, this is kind of more in your lane than mine. From a legal standpoint, it doesn't worry me so much as if there is one thing that American history has taught us, and the failed Reconstruction efforts after the Civil War, and that, you know, other countries that have experienced these types of authoritarian efforts, is that if you don't deal with them head on and you just think you'll let the conduct of January 6th slide, you'll let the attacks on democracy slide because you want to be conciliatory, you want healing, that it doesn't actually heal it. It actually incubates it for the next time. It's not that I'm worried about the charges that have been brought. I'm more concerned with the incentive structure that it set up for the next time, if people feel like, well, we were able to go this far last time and not wind up in trouble, so we can push it even a little further next time.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, Mark. I mean, one of the main reasons why the North gave up on enforcing Black voting rights in the South during Reconstruction was this desire to move on, was this desire for reconciliation. And of course, there was no reconciliation. The South was just able to do whatever it wanted for nearly 100 years in terms of disenfranchising Black Americans. And that had a big impact on the politics of the country writ large, not just of the South. What worries me is the political culture in this country that just allows someone like Donald Trump to be able to run again with essentially no consequences for what he did. And the fact that I think a lot of other countries would have dealt with this differently. They would have had some kind of mechanism to prevent someone like Trump from running again.
Well, it was an impeachment. We had an impeachment.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. That would have prevented it. And how many Republicans did it? 7 senators?
And thank you, Mitch McConnell, for giving this blistering speech. There's no doubt that this president caused an insurrection on January 6th.
Well, remember what he did? He delayed the trial.
Yeah, and then used the delay of the trial.
And then used that as an excuse to not
impeach
him.
Yeah.
Right.
So it was classic McConnell. I mean, he created the situation to get himself off the hook on the ultimate vote. But yeah, I mean, impeachment, or there might have been other mechanisms, but I think just the fact that this is even happening, that the guy who tried to overturn an election and incite an insurrection is now the front runner for his party's.
He's not only the front runner, but have you seen DeSantis on the campaign trail? I've never seen a guy less comfortable with human beings. I mean, he'll say to a guy, what's your name? And the guy says, it's Hal Brenby. And he'll go, good. And then move on. I mean, it's crazy how bad he is. I don't know if he makes it to Iowa. I mean, man, oh man, I used to love meeting people on the campaign trail because, you know, I kind of like people. I'm kind of interested in them. He doesn't seem to have that. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Mark Elias and Ari Berman.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal.
all that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Well, let's look at what are you concerned about going into this next cycle, either carryover from last time or concerns that may be new?
Look, on the legal front and the voting rights front, what I'm worried about is that the left has, in many quarters, decided to move on from the threats to democracy. But it is the central organizing thesis of the Republican Party. So let me give you a couple of statistics around this and then tell you what I'm worried about for 2024. Democracy.gov, which is a website that I created, mm-hmm. It tracks all voting litigation, not just litigation I'm involved in, but all voting litigation. And in 2022, there were 175 separate voting lawsuits. This is excluding redistricting. In 2020, by the way, there were 150. So we went from 150 to 175. So there was more litigation in 2022 than in 2020. And of course, in 2020, you had 65 cases after Election Day. So it's the real comparator is 175 versus 85. But of that 175 lawsuits, a majority of them were actually filed by Republicans and conservatives. The reason why I start with that is that I think most people listening to this are unaware that there are any lawsuits against states saying that voting is too easy. But yet there are actually more lawsuits. Right now, California is under lawsuit. Illinois is under lawsuit by conservatives who say voting is too easy and trying to repeal statutes that make voting more possible. The Republicans have brought litigation against North Carolina to make voting harder. They recently lost a lawsuit in the state Supreme Court of Arizona to try to ban mail-in voting. And so when you look at that and you add on to that the fact that you have legislature after legislature passing new voter suppression laws and election subversion laws, in some instances, these are the second or the third law on top of each other, you get some picture of what the conservative and Republican playbook is, which is they know they can't win through a majoritarian election. So their goal is to change the rules of voting to disincentivize or to dissuade or to suppress or to subvert the votes of Black, brown, and young voters. And that's their strategy. And they are doggedly at it. They are doggedly at it. And I worry that on our side, you know, there is kind of like a generalized concern that these things are happening, but they are not nearly as closely paid attention to, other than, frankly, by people like Ari, who is constantly writing about it.
Yeah, I would just echo Mark's point, Al, and say that pretty much every Republican-controlled state passed some kind of new restriction on voting following the 2020 election, and many states have passed multiple new restrictions on voting, and this will be the first presidential election that these restrictions will be in effect for. And the presidential election landscape is different than a midterm, right? We're going to have much higher turnout in 2024 probably than we had in 2022. And there's going to be many more infrequent voters showing up. And that's the kind of people who might be targeted by these kind of restrictions. And I think there's a feeling that because Democrats fared relatively well in 2022, because a lot of the election deniers lost, that means that we don't have a crisis for democracy anymore. And I think that's really dangerous because these laws are still into effect. They're going to try to recruit smoother election deniers than last time. They're going to try to recruit people that are a little bit more sophisticated in terms of how they might try to overturn or alter the rules of an election, but they'll basically have the same election denier playbook. They'll try to pass more sophisticated efforts to try to subvert the will of the voters. I'll just give you one example of something that was really disturbing to me, and I know Mark too. The Texas legislature basically passed a bill dictating how elections would be run in the state's largest county, Harris County, the largest blue county in Texas, where the legislature fired the election administrator in Harris County. It was the only county in the state where they decided to fire the election administrator. And they said,
what county is this? Where Austin is or where Dallas is?
Where Houston is.
Houston. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So there's nearly 5 million people there. It's the third largest county in the country. It's the largest county in Texas. It's the largest blue county in Texas. So it really, in many ways, determines the swing of Texas politics. And they decided to A, fire the election administrator only in this one county. And then B, they said that if there were any kind of violations, even minor things like a voting machine malfunctioning and preventing someone from voting, that could then allow the Republican-appointed Secretary of State to take over election operations in that county. Again, only Harris County. So, I mean, you had a legislature essentially dictating, this is how elections are going to be run in the largest blue county in the state. And if we don't like it, we're just going to take over election operations altogether. I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing we were worried about happening in 2022 with all of these election deniers being elected. But it got a fraction of the coverage of someone like Carrie Lake running for office, for example. So I think they've become more sophisticated in the kind of things that they're doing now compared to what they tried to do in 2020.
Are they continuing to, of course they are, to go with that there was a lot of fraud, or with that myth? Are they trying
to do
that?
In Harris County, there were some election problems in 2022 because it was the first election where they used a paper ballot system. They also had new restrictions they had to follow based on the voter suppression law that the Texas legislature passed in 2021. So that created some problems in Harris County where some polling locations ran out of paper ballots. But basically, Republicans, they did what Common Cause Texas called it, the Texas version of the big lie, where they basically said that Democrats who ran the county intentionally took away paper ballots from Republican areas so that Republicans wouldn't be able to vote and they would lose close elections. Now, ironically, that's exactly what's being done in black and brown neighborhoods for decades. But nonetheless, that's what they argued. And basically, they said, you know, all of the elections were fraudulent in Harris County because Democrats intentionally disenfranchised Republicans. There was no evidence that that happened. But that's kind of the argument they were using. So it was fraud, but it was kind of like a more of an iteration of the big lie argument they were using.
Al, I think we'd be making a mistake, at least with respect to the House of Representatives and control of these legislatures, to not also note that there is another way you suppress voters, which is by engaging in the kinds of outrageous gerrymandering that we've seen Republicans. And that's not over. You know, we're going to see Republicans redraw maps in several states in ways that would have defied common sense or defied even imagination a few redistricting cycles ago. North Carolina, they're going to redistrict as an example. DeSantis redistricted in the face of so-called fair district amendments in a way that specifically targeted Al Lawson, a black member of Congress. And so it's part of a larger ethos on the right to try to use the rules to affect the outcomes.
And when did the Supreme Court say we're not going to get involved, we can't get involved in any partisan gerrymandering?
In 2019. In the Rucho decision. But the kind of things that Mark is describing are such blatant racial gerrymanders that it's pretty amazing that those kind of things haven't been struck down in court.
Which presumably they can be involved in.
But I mean, I think the fear is that the Supreme Court is very shortly going to also make it very difficult, if not impossible, to strike down racial gerrymandering too, leaving many fewer options here. And I think it's just amazing. If you go back and you look at the landscape for voting rights before the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013 and the landscape afterwards, it's just dramatically different. I mean, Republicans are doing things in states like Florida they would have never considered before. I mean, the fact that DeSantis tried to dismantle and did dismantle two majority black districts, or districts in which black voters were able to choose their candidates of choice, That would have never passed muster under the Voting Rights Act as it was interpreted by the courts for nearly 50 years before the Supreme Court gutted it in 2013. So I think Republicans are just going further and further to push the envelope here, and they feel like they're going to get whatever they want from the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court has already said, we don't care about partisan gerrymandering. And now they may be willing to say, we don't really care about racial gerrymandering either. And that just makes, I mean, the options for trying to strike down gerrymandering just keep becoming more and more limited. Doesn't mean it's impossible, right, Mark? I mean, you've won a number of these cases, but yep. I feel like it's getting progressively harder.
Yeah, it's getting harder and it's getting harder and harder for the reasons you said. You know, we won a case in Alabama under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
They said it was too late.
It was two Trump-appointed judges and a Reagan-appointed judge who said that the state of Alabama violated the Voting Rights Act. That case is now before the Supreme Court. We're going to get a decision sometime this month. There's no reason why the Supreme Court should have taken a Section 2 case out of Alabama. I mean, you know, the lower court applied the standard that the courts applied is at this point more than 50 years. The Supreme Court recently announced it's going to hear argument in a racial gerrymandering case out of South Carolina that the NAACP has brought. So those are all potential troubling outcomes. And of course,
they're troubling because they shouldn't even have to take them.
Correct. There's no reason. Like the law of Section 2, first of all, Section 2 is the part of the Voting Rights Act that is still in place that the Chief Justice assured us when he wrote the opinion to strike down Section 5, the part that Ari was talking about, would still have nationwide application.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I worry, frankly, personally, just as a, you know, on my own behalf, that there's also a widely developing asymmetry in which Democratic-controlled states have turned to commissions and fair district processes.
Right.
And Republican states are not. And so you have California, which has a commission. You have Colorado, which has a—
New York, the Supreme Court overruled the House very heavily gerrymandered map and wrote a fair one, which—
Yeah, although that I don't think the map they drew was a fair one. It was drawn, to be clear, by a special master under the auspices of a very Republican judge in a very rural part of New York. Al, I know you're familiar with New York. The trial in that case, the hearings in that case took place in Steuben County, New York, probably not a county you've ever visited. It's one of the three or four most Republican counties in the state. But you know, there may be an opportunity for a new map in New York. I would hope in your home state of Minnesota that Democrats, now that they control the full process, would look at the map there. That was it was a court drawn map. It's not an inherently unfair map, but I think there are parts of it that, frankly, the Democrats could improve upon without engaging in partisan.
Well, thank God we took the Senate, we took the House, and we have the governor. So we got an amazing amount.
But just imagine if the Republicans controlled the full process, what they would do. And all I'm saying is Democrats shouldn't do that. They should just do enough to make sure the districts accurately reflect the population of the state.
Mark makes a really good point, though, about the bait and switch that's going on with the Supreme Court, that I don't feel like it's getting enough attention, because I think the media writ large still is treating the Supreme Court like a good faith actor. And
really?
It's not. It's
why
not
is that?
Faith
why is that? But why
it's a corrupt political body? Because I think we've institutionalized these norms for so long that it's really hard to feel like one branch of government, the branch of government that in many ways the public had the most faith in for so many years, has just become a corrupt, rigged body.
Why would anyone treat it as a good faith body?
Well, I think because of the legacy of it, I think they think of it as Brown versus Board of Education and all of Roe versus Wade and all of these landmark decisions. That's how the court was thought of for so many years by a large majority of the public, that it's taken a while to get to a point where you realize that this is just a corrupt, rigged court, because over and over they keep saying when they do things, oh, we're not doing this.
Yeah, but Brown v. Board created a new right. Dobbs ended a right. I mean, they're doing the opposite.
Well, I completely agree with you, Al. I'm just saying this is how I think why people think of the court for a lot of years and the way that they think of it.
Ari, not to turn you into the defender of the entire media, but it is as a reader and as a consumer of media and as someone who follows the Supreme Court, I note that a lot of the good reporting about the court is actually not by the people who cover the court every day.
Yes. I think that's a really good point. I think that.
So why is that?
I'll tell you, Mark.
Who are we have Dahlia Lithwick on.
The few times that I've walked in to the Supreme Court press corps to cover voting rights cases, you know, I'm getting dirty looks. And, you know, people like me that aren't there all the time and are tight with the justices, they feel like we're outsiders in their little club. And I think that basically it's a fiefdom. The Supreme Court press corps, it's little fiefdom. It's a very small group of Washington insiders. They're not bad people. I read a lot of the reporting, but I think that basically it's a small club that is very comfortable with the structure of the court, very cozy in many cases with the justices on both sides. You know, there are journalists that have been friends with justices on both sides of the aisle for many, many years. And it kind of feels like a new form of an old boys club where there's a small number of people covering 9 people who are appointed for life. And there's lots of things that go unsaid. How did all the people that know Clarence Thomas the most, that have covered him closely, not know about all the things he was doing, not look more into what his wife was up to, not look more into his friendships with donors? I mean, this is the kind of thing that, like, you'd think that the people that are closest to it would have the most incentive to try to uncover. But I think it's because it's such a clubby institution.
Well, they don't have any incentive.
Why aren't Supreme Court decisions live streamed?
I mean, good question.
It's crazy how arcane the system is. I mean, we can watch every congressional hearing pretty much on live stream, but we have to constantly update on SCOTUS blog for someone to run in and out of a room to get opinions on what happens before the highest court. I mean, it's just the whole way the Supreme Court works is so crazy. But just to make my final point, the Supreme Court said in Shelby County versus Holder in 2013, we're striking down the requirement that states with a long history of discrimination have to approve their voting changes with the federal government, but we're not touching the other part of the Voting Rights Act that applies nationwide and is permanent. Well, then they turned around and gutted that case in 2021. Then they, in the redistricting case where they said, we're not going to strike down partisan gerrymandering, we're not even going to review partisan gerrymandering cases, they say, well, we're not doing anything to disturb racial gerrymandering. Well, now they're hearing a case that is probably going to make it very, very difficult, if not impossible, to strike down racial gerrymandering. They also said, we're going to defer to state Supreme Courts. Well, now they're hearing another case, Moore versus Harper, that can completely neuter the power of state Supreme Courts and say that legislatures can basically do whatever they want.
Are they still going to review that because the court changed?
Well, right. That's a big, Mark, do you have theories? No one really knows what they're going to do.
I don't think we know. What happened, so that everyone listening, the North Carolina courts struck down the North Carolina map as unconstitutional under the state constitution.
And this is when it was a Democratic court,
correct,
or progressive
then
court.
Then there were elections and the court flipped to be Republican. The Republican state Supreme Court then reheard those same cases, which was a little odd unto itself, and came to the opposite conclusion, said that there is no cause for partisan gerrymandering, and undid that. In the meantime, before that second case by the state Supreme Court,
there is no cause to rule that there's partisan,
right, the case goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. And so the U.S. Supreme Court is now reviewing a court ruling that has been essentially undone. And so, full disclosure, my law firm represents the Harper in Moore v. Harper. Mm-hmm. All of the pro-voting organizations, the state of North Carolina, everyone other than the Republican legislature and, curiously, Common Cause says that there's no case to decide and therefore the case should be dismissed. The Republican legislators and Common Cause think that there is a case to decide.
And the scary decision that the Supreme Court, or that the state legislature was proposing here, that the outcome would be that the state Supreme Court really can't overrule the state legislature in terms of writing the voting rules. Is that right?
That is the case that's before the Supreme Court.
Right. And that's very, very, very frightening. Presumably, so right now, the state legislatures can overturn
state courts.
A state Supreme Court, yes, can overturn the state legislature's map and say, no, this is partisan gerrymandering.
Right.
But if the Supreme Court can't overrule partisan gerrymandering, and this case holds in Harper, then is it impossible for the Supreme Court to overturn
yeah. then it's immunized. And it's worse than just the redistricting arena. The same clause of the Constitution, the election clause, applies to all federal election laws. So I tallied up, there are 23 cases right now in state courts around the country to strike down state voter suppression laws. And if the Supreme Court rules the way the Republican legislature of North Carolina wants, all of those 23 cases go away and all of those laws stand. And that will be a catastrophe for democracy.
So this is just democracy's on the line all the time. And it's the Supreme Court. I mean, Shelby County was a terrible decision. Citizens United was a terrible decision. In both decisions, premises that they were based on were shown to be were disproven. In Citizens United, it was Kennedy wrote in his decision that we would have disclosure. The internet is up now, and we can have instant disclosure. And of course, we don't have disclosure because Republicans, we tried to pass that, and Republicans all voted against it.
Look, I'll let Ari speak to the motivations, but whether it is bad guessing or Republican malfeasance or disingenuousness on the court, in case after case, I mean, Ari correctly cites the Chief Justice said that, you know, don't worry that there's no federal cause of action for partisan gerrymandering because the state courts can still police that. Well, now we've got Moore v. Harper and we're waiting on the outcome there. When Shelby County came out, not only did the Supreme Court say that Section 2 would have continued vitality throughout the country, and now that's being questioned, but in Citizens United, as you say about disclosure, in case after case, the Supreme Court is predicating its outcome on a assumption about how the political branches will respond, which just doesn't turn out to be true.
Or they know that their decisions.
Right, that's what I said. I leave it to you, exactly. Ari, whether it's.
Because, I mean, you look at what Alito said in Dobbs. He said, we're just returning the issue of abortion to the democratically elected state legislatures. Well, the Supreme Court has made those legislatures in Republican-controlled states as undemocratic as possible by allowing voter suppression laws to stand, by allowing extreme gerrymandering to stand, by allowing those states to be flooded with big money. I mean, so the idea that they're saying, okay, we're going to return an issue to a branch of government that the court itself has shaped to its liking over and over and over, to me just shows the bad faith reasoning. And I think it shows why we need to stop taking the court at face value and start describing these opinions as part of a longer term political project by the GOP to try to undermine the will of the people. That's really what's going on here. And the Supreme Court has become a major driver of this effort. And I think that just people are just now, largely because of Dobbs, finally coming to grips with that. But you're right, Al. To me, Citizens United and Shelby County were the twin evils that really created the anti-democratic momentum within the Republican Party.
And both based on premises that weren't true. So let me ask you whether this is naive or just incredibly stupid. You write an opinion like Kennedy did and said, the great thing about this is that there'll be instant disclosure of who's spending the money. So then that doesn't happen. Why can't you revisit it? Why can't someone revisit the case and go like, the whole opinion hinged on this and it turned out not to be true? Why don't you guys should look at, you have to look at it again. You have to. And then on Shelby County, it was all hinged on we don't need it anymore because it's worked. And there isn't racist gerrymandering anymore. And then boom, you know, North Carolina targets its African Americans with almost surgical precision, as the Fourth Circuit ruled. Why doesn't someone just bring a case and say, like, you're wrong?
So
you were wrong.
You could bring that case. I mean, one of the least I think covered cases was actually a case brought right after Citizens United by the state of Montana that said, look, you said there wasn't a record of corruption. We in Montana can show you a record of corruption that's unique to corporations. And the Supreme Court didn't care. Like, the problem is you can bring the case, but do you really think that the current composition of the Supreme Court is going to come to a better outcome.
You're bringing it to the same court, and now you're bringing it to a worse court.
Worse court, right? I mean, Ari, I would take the same court.
I know you debate this. Voting rights lawyers debate whether they even want to file these cases these days.
Because they'll just have a new wrinkle.
They're worried about setting worse precedent. Now, I mean, Mark, you could speak to this much more than I could, because then an action can become a reason for paralysis, right? But I get the sense here. Every time we bring a Voting Rights Act case, that could just lead the Supreme Court to further and further weaken the Voting Rights Act. Now, maybe they're going to do that anyway, but I'm just saying that's a debate that is now going on in voting rights circles.
So what I'm suggesting is something of a debate, at least. At least what the question I asked wasn't idiotic.
No,
that was too long.
It's not idiotic. It's just it wouldn't be successful.
It wouldn't be successful.
Court to change their mind.
I'm not in the camp that says we shouldn't bring cases because we may make bad precedent, because then you wind up letting if the Republican legislatures think you won't sue them, they will do even worse things. You have to show the other side you're willing to use the tools available. But that said, I think that part of what you're getting at, Al, and part of what I hope on the left develops is a longer range jurisprudence that we want to get behind. You know, a lot of these things that Republicans are doing now, they didn't originate a year ago or 2 years ago. This has been a mission of theirs for a long time. I mean, look at the fight, Ari, you mentioned over abortion, how long they have had this mission. And I just hope that our side doesn't get distracted from the attacks on democracy and not dedicate the time and energy necessary to build a positive jurisprudence so that when the composition of the courts improves, we're able to have something in place.
The other thing that I find surprising is that why more Democrats haven't embraced changing the structure of the Supreme Court. Part of the problem is that a lot of Democratic elected officials are still treating the court as a good faith branch of government. I mean, it's like they're begging them to testify on ethics. Why don't they just pass new ethics rules and say, this is what you have to do? I mean, I understand they don't control the House. They can't just do that. But I mean, they had power over the last 2 years. And maybe they couldn't have changed the entire structure of the Supreme Court with a 50-vote majority. I get that. I'm a political realist. But Biden didn't even want to have the conversation. I mean, his Supreme Court commission did some good work, but it pretty much was an attempt to try to bury the issue. Why wouldn't you try to attack this issue head on, either to put pressure on the court so that they might actually change some of their views, even if they don't believe them, but they might feel like there's some ramifications of it, or to try to change the public's mind in such a way that they become supportive of things like this. It just seems to me that this was taken off the table very early on by top Democrats in a way that I think was a mistake, and not even for political reasons, but I think for substantive reasons. I don't think you could look at the way this court was structured and not believe that it's an illegitimate court based on the 63 majority they have now.
They lied about what they were doing. They said it was because that when Scalia died, there's already been votes cast in New Hampshire. Then, of course, when Ginsburg dies, it's like late September. Coney Barrett gets sworn in 8 days before the election, when tens of millions of votes, real votes, not in a primary, but actually for the president. And it was all about the American people have the right to pick the president who's going to choose next. The hypocrisy, and they don't care about it. They said, if they lose the Senate, will you not let the president nominate? And they go, yeah, of course we wouldn't. They don't hide it, right?
I just think it's a mistake not to have the conversation. I think if your goal is restoring democratic norms, then one of the ways to restore democratic norms is to restore democracy to the Supreme Court. I think right now, it's not a democratic body in the sense that it doesn't reflect the will of the voters, and it was composed in an illegitimate manner that defied basic democratic norms. So, Mark, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but it just seems to me that we should have had more of a conversation about it within democratic circles.
I agree with you. We should have more conversations about it. I also think that when you look at some of the reforms, for example, expanding the number of justices, it doesn't take the need to even call the court illegitimate to do it. There's nothing magical about 9. The Supreme Court was not, the number of justices was a historical accident. It has nothing to do with anything that was planned out this way. If you had the same number of justices today as you had when this historical accident sort of took place, you would have 13, because there was one for every circuit, plus there's the DC circuit and the federal circuit. You know, the Supreme Court only hears, because of its nine justices and the way in which they select cases, they're only hearing 60 or 70 cases. Well, look at the volume of litigation and set aside for a second the cases that we mostly focus on. There are lots of cases that the Supreme Court is not deciding and not hearing that have no partisan valence, but which a larger court would be able to hear. So I think that there are good reasons to do that. I also think, by the way, we as Democrats should be spending more time talking about expanding the size of the courts of appeals and the district courts. You know, getting a case heard, you know, Al, you started this conversation by talking a little bit about some of the criminal cases. If a case gets filed in Washington, D.C. right now, a criminal case, and the criminal cases move faster than civil cases, you know, a complex criminal case will take a year before it gets to trial. A civil case, you know, because they get bumped for the criminal cases because of the Speedy Trial Act, could take multiples of years. Well, one way you deal with that is you simply appoint a lot more judges to those lower courts. And so I think that those are things that don't get caught up in some of what maybe, Ari, the apprehensions are among some Democrats. I don't have all those apprehensions, but there are practical reasons why I think some of these reforms could be addressed on those merits.
I mean, Al, weren't you on the Judiciary Committee?
Yes, I was.
So you have interviewed some of these justices under oath.
Well, yeah, the only Republican ones was Gorsuch. Who I asked about the frozen truck or what he would have done.
I was going to say the only thing I remember from any Supreme Court hearing was you having an exchange about some poor guy who like died on the side of the road or something.
Well, would have died unless he had did the smart thing. It was 13 below. He was out there freezing. He had fallen asleep. His brother-in-law had called him. He had hypothermia. And the company told him, nope, don't leave. We're going to come get you. But it had been hours. And he unhitched the trailer, which had frozen brakes. That was the problem. So he did that. He went out and found a place to warmed up and came back. And they fired him because he, quote, didn't drive the vehicle. They said, you can either drive the vehicle out or stay there. And because he unhitched the payload, under Gorsuch's thinking, he didn't drive the vehicle out. And he was in the minority. The other three judge panel, the other two said, no, he drove it out. Also, he could have frozen to death. And I kept asking Gorsuch, what would you have done? Oh, I don't know, Senator. I had empathy for the man, but I didn't put myself in his shoes. Well, that's what does empathy even mean? Oh, God, I did not like him.
It's just, you know, again, that I think it's just Republicans, back to Mark's earlier point, have been so much better at playing political hardball than Democrats. I mean, they would have never allowed a situation where somehow or another one of their justices was blocked for a year, and then another was nominated.
What would we have done?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what Republicans would have done, but I just think they would have found some sort of way to put a Merrick Garland on the court or to prevent a Neil Gorsuch from getting on there. I mean, I get that there's political realities and you can't do anything about these kind of things.
Well, you remember they got rid of the,
the filibuster.
This filibuster on Gorsuch. And so now every one of these is going to be hyperpartisan.
They got rid of the filibuster to construct a 6-3 Supreme Court supermajority, but Democrats, namely two people who were basically are no longer Democrats, wouldn't get rid of the filibuster to protect voting rights for the next generation. I mean, that's the kind of political asymmetry we're talking about.
And Al, look, they are rolling out right now a theory in the U.S. Supreme Court in Moore v. Harper that basically says there is no state court judicial review.
This is the case we were talking about.
Right. Okay. That's a made up doctrine. I mean, it's just, let's call it what it is. It is a made up doctrine. They recently, in an area of law I don't really practice much in anymore, but in the administrative law context, they created something called the major questions doctrine. That is also a made up doctrine. Like
they'll do anything.
Right. So I will just, I'm going to go on record on your podcast, and in 10 years or whenever it comes up, you'll replay this. If there is a Republican president who wants to put someone on the Supreme Court and there is a Democratic Senate, he will say he has talked to senators on both sides. He has sought their advice. He has gotten their informal consent to the extent he needs it, and then he'll put them on the court. And as fanciful as that sounds right now, and I'm not saying that that is, by the way, right by any stretch of the imagination, but like, that's what he'll do.
Well, I want to hear the part where he says, I've gotten their consent. And then the Democratic then leader.
So now
well,
this
then
person
the Democratic leader goes, okay, here we are. Did anyone give their consent? No. So you're lying, Mr. President.
I mean, Ari, I don't know if you think that that's too extreme for the Republicans.
That's exactly what I'm saying. If Republicans had faced a Merrick Garland situation, they would have figured out a way to put Merrick Garland on the court. Like, I think Mark's absolutely right. They would have just recessed to appoint him and said, challenge it, try to change it, you know, try to challenge it after the fact. But he's going on the court. I think they would have done that. Because I mean, we've seen Republicans do things like this. I mean, They made up things left and right to try to overturn an election. They've then tried to institutionalize the made up stuff before the Supreme Court. I mean, basically what they're asking the Supreme Court to do is to sign off on the theory that the Trump campaign used to try to overturn the election.
Correct.
In all of these places. I mean, that's what they're trying to do. They are trying to get the Supreme Court to sign off on what could credibly, I guess, be described as their most important theory behind, to the extent that there was a theory, their most important theory behind why the election should be overturned, right? Because state legislatures have unfettered power to essentially do whatever they want. I mean, that's what John Eastman was arguing. And that's what he argued in 2020. And that's what he's arguing before the Supreme Court now.
Yeah, well, he said he was going to lose 8-1. And I imagine that was Thomas.
Right? That was 8-1 in terms of 2020. That wasn't 8-1.
Yes,
in terms
that's of what I'm saying.
Harper, right?
Right. Right.
I mean, four justices have already endorsed the independent state legislature theory.
Right.
So, I mean, it could get dismissed for any number of reasons, but it doesn't seem like it's going to be 8-1, even though it's essentially the same theory. Right, Mark?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right.
Okay, I want to move on this coming election. What are we worried about this coming election in terms of election law and election administration?
So I think Ari said something really, really important, and I'm going to repeat it, and I hope everyone listens to this. For people who thought the 2020 election hung by, you know, not by a string, but by, you know, was tattered by the end, a lot of them looked at 2022 and they're like, well, now everything seems to be working just fine. Our election system is not any stronger. In fact, in some ways, it's weaker. You know, the ability, the funding mechanisms around some of these counties and states has deteriorated. The voter experience, the laws have changed in ways that make the voter experience harder. Fewer good people want to work on elections, either on a volunteer basis or in a paid capacity. And so what Ari said earlier is, and I'm going to use my words, not yours, Ari, but I hope I am capturing this, is that 2022 wasn't a stress test. You know, the people who vote in the midterms are people who are going to be voters no matter what, right? They're turned out in an off year. And the system doesn't face the same kind of volume. So at a very, very baseline matter level, what I worry about is that the system is under more and more stress than it was in 2020, and that the progressives have sort of gotten this false sense of security by what happened in 2022, that it's actually a more robust system when it's actually weaker. Aria, did I capture that roughly?
Yeah,
right?
I think that's a really good point, Mark. I mean, the thing is, what has changed since 2020 and what happened in 2022 is in a number of really key states, we dodged a bullet, right? but we didn't bring the patient all the way back to health. We haven't actually done anything in a lot of these places to make the election system better. Now, in some places they have, right? Michigan flipped and they've passed a number of laws that should lead to better elections. But in a number of states like Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, where at best there's divided government, the laws have not changed, right?
Do you think that the different Supreme Court in Wisconsin could change some of
Sure,
Wisconsin?
It could change it. But I'm just saying, as of now, the election system has not been secured in those states. And then in states like Georgia and Texas and North Carolina, et cetera, the laws have changed for the worse. So, I mean, there is no baseline protection for voting rights that has been passed since 2020 to give you ultimate confidence in how the election would go.
And that is all the usual stuff, just making it harder to vote.
I think you might be downplaying the significance of all the usual stuff, Al.
Targeting college kids. You have to live, they send to your home address in Pennsylvania. If you go to school in Texas and you don't get a reply, you're off the rolls.
Yeah, right? Look, I think what Ari is saying, or at least for myself, one of the challenges I face in talking to people who have means about what voter suppression means is that it is so foreign to them that sometimes it's hard for them to imagine. So how long would you wait in line to vote? You're a former U.S. senator. You're a very prominent American. You have lots of resources. Would you give up 3 hours of your day to wait in line to vote? Would you give up 5 hours if you knew it was going to take 5 hours? For someone now who is poor, or someone who now has daycare or childcare obligations, that is not just making it harder. That is effectively taking away their right to vote. And when you look at who waits in line to vote in America, it's basically Black voters and college students. And so it is a tax that legislators are able to put on the most vulnerable voters, without it being felt by people who don't live in those communities. You know, there's a statistic I'll give you, and you know, then I'll get off the soapbox. From the 2020 primary in Georgia, we sued after there were long lines, and in the 6 metro counties of Atlanta, if you were in a precinct that was 90% or more registered Black voters, you waited in line an average of 51 minutes to vote. If you were in the same 6 counties, so there's no argument about resource allocation, there's no argument about different personnel, same 6 counties, and you were in a precinct that was 90% or more white, you waited an average to vote 6 minutes. 6 minutes versus 51 minutes. Now you understand what it means to say you can't have food and water in line. It is the final indignity being heaped on folks who are waiting in line. And those folks are not the white voters. If you are waiting 6 minutes in line, you don't have time to eat. And so there is a fundamental structural problem that these voter suppression laws interact with that create not just barriers to voting, but fundamentally just disenfranchise voters.
So your anticipation is that this is going to continue and, if anything, get worse.
It is getting worse. There were more anti-voting laws introduced this year and more anti-voting laws enacted this year than in 2021. In 2021, there were anti-voting laws enacted and Major League Baseball moved an All-Star game. The corporate America took out a full-page ad. Democratic legislators walked out of Texas. It was leading the national news. That's still going on. You know, Idaho passed a law banning college IDs. Ohio passed an omnibus voter suppression law. Florida passed yet another omnibus voter suppression law. Texas, as Ari said, is passed these laws that literally target one county, which happens to be the most Democratic county in the state. So it's not getting better. It's getting worse.
Okay.
Well, that's what I was asking. I think the positive takeaway from 2022 going into 2024 is that 2022 showed without a doubt that a majority of Americans want to defend democracy, and that if given a choice between someone who believes in democracy and someone who doesn't, they will choose the person who believes in democracy. But there was also that was the leading issue. You could argue there were two huge issues in the 2022 election, and they were related. They were abortion and democracy. And of course, the Dobbs decision was a result of an undemocratic political system. So in many ways, they were one and the same. But to have all of those election deniers defeated, it required democracy to be in the minds of people. And it required a movement that could persuade a majority of Americans to believe that, as Joe Biden said over and over, democracy is on the ballot. And I think Mark's concern and my concern is that in 2024, that's getting overshadowed by other things, right? That's getting overshadowed by the circus in the Republican primary. That's getting overshadowed by so many things. And people feel like democracy isn't on the ballot anymore, when the same things are at stake in 2024 that were at stake in 2022. And by the way, the big thing we haven't talked about is Trump is on the ballot, or might be on the ballot in 2024 in a way that he wasn't in 2022. The stakes for democracy are as great in the next election as they were in the last one, but it doesn't seem to be getting the same level of attention or being treated with the same level of urgency.
So what are the points that we need to be anticipating going forward, or is this just happening daily in different places?
I mean, this is how daily it's happening. So Dobbs comes out, a bunch of states decide that they're going to restrict abortion rights. Well, a lot of those states have ballot initiatives. So folks who want to protect abortion rights decide they're going to put things on the ballot and try to protect abortion rights through the ballot initiative.
They get it above 50%. Now they want to change it to 60.
Yeah. So Ohio, Ohio then passes a law to change the threshold from 50 to 60. Recently, Ohio Secretary Frank LaRose said, quote, the effort to move the threshold is, quote, 100% about keeping a radical pro-abortion amendment out of the Ohio's constitution.
Right.
So like that's just rigging the rules because you don't like democracy.
Well, couldn't they, what do they need to pass that law? Because couldn't like 51% of them make the threshold 90%?
Yeah, they can.
I mean, why not? You know,
I mean, the hopeful thing is that a majority of people can defeat the measure at the ballot. I mean, it should never have gotten that stage. And Mark, it sounds like there's a pretty strong argument to throw it out in court to begin with.
Yes, my law firm is suing to block it, to throw it out.
So it may not even get to that point.
Okay.
But I mean, it's just crazy. This is, again, the same kind of thing we're talking about with the Supreme Court, which is that if they want to do something, they will figure out a way to do it. It doesn't matter. We will have a political system in which there is no recourse to try to change the undemocratic things that they're doing, because all of the options to try to check the undemocratic things that they're doing will be eventually systematically taken away one by one by one. And I think that's the scary future, where our ability to protect democracy becomes so difficult to potentially non-existent. Now, I don't think we're heading there. I don't think that's what's happening. But I think that's what they would like to happen. I think their ultimate end game.
Well, then let's end with your optimism here by explaining why you're so optimistic.
Well,
they'll fail.
I don't think I would be described.
It's the first time I've ever heard Ari described as an optimist.
Yeah.
You're saying, no, I don't think that's going to happen. And I go,
I don't think it's going to happen that democracy will become non-existent. But what I think is, it's very probable that rights that we've cherished for decades will keep getting narrowed or taken away.
I have to listen back, because that's not quite what I heard. I was all set for the, oh, good.
I guess the thing I'll say is that if there's a way for a majority of Americans who believe in democracy to channel their views through the political and the legal system, they can win these fights. But if the ability of a majority of Americans who believe in democracy to defend democracy, if those avenues are limited or taken away, then it's very, very possible that the democratic rights that we've cherished for so many years will disappear, because that's what's been happening over the past decade.
Okay, so the charge to my listeners is to keep awake and do everything you can in your locality, your state, to fight for democracy, to fight for fair elections, to fight these bad guys, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that that's exactly right. Because if the issue you care most about in this world is climate, we are not going to solve the problems of climate without a functioning democracy. If the issue that you are primarily motivated about is abortion, we are not going to protect women's health without a functioning democracy. We're not going to tackle the problems of childhood poverty and education. We're not going to tackle the problems of inequality and income. We're not going to tackle any of the problems that progressives may list as their top concern unless we solve the problem of authoritarianism that is threatening our democracy and is undermining free and fair elections. So what is it that your audience can do? Is they can do the same thing that you're doing, Al, today. Every one of them has a town square that they can go stand out in the middle of and speak to. For you, it's a very big town square. You're an international celebrity. People listen to you on podcasts. They see you on TV. You can speak out and a lot of people listen.
Well, in Hungary, they've been listening to me on the democracy.
For others, their town square. For others, their town square may only be their friends. It may be the people they hang out at the diner or their family around the kitchen table. It may be their Facebook group
or their town square.
But what I'd ask everyone to do is not retreat from discussing democracy. Not say, "Well, I don't want to discuss it because it's divisive." But rather lean into discussing it. Stand in your town square and say, it's not okay what's happening. It's not okay when we see the courts undermining personal freedoms. It's not okay when legislatures are changing the threshold for ballot initiatives. It's not okay when candidates are running on a big lie platform. Because it is only by ordinary Americans all speaking out that we will be able to win the war and the battle for hearts and minds, because democracy relies not just on the rules and on the laws and the norms, but on how people feel about things. And so that's what I think your audience should do.
Well, that's your charge, folks. And thank you, guys. This has been a great one for a change. Well, no, you're always great, but I mean, most of my podcasts are just dreck. Anyway, but this is, I think for my listeners, a big pick-me-up, and they may even listen to my next one now. So thank you, guys.
Thanks so much, Al.
Thank you, Al.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.